guys, this is Dave Stovall, and you're listening to another Renew Audio Post. Have you ever asked yourself questions like, how should the church relate to the culture? Should we try to blend in as best as possible, or should we always try to see ourselves as a fairly uninfluential subculture? Could there be a better way for the church to relate to the world around us? Well, recently, Renew editorial director Daniel McCoy got to interview Christian Ray Flores, rock star turned pastor. As someone who has lived in numerous cultures and speaks many different languages, Christian Ray has a very unique and helpful perspective on how Christians should navigate the relationship between church and culture. So let's listen in on their conversation.
Tell me about your days as a musician, as a rock star. You know, what was the biggest crowd that you played for?
Well, it probably depends. If it was solo, I think solo, the biggest crowd was about 60,000, something like that. If it was part of some other big event, like a big festival or something on a city square, 500,000, like,
wow,
pretty big.
Man. What's the funnest part of, you know, of being a musician? What was the most meaningful moment, I guess?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One is just in the body of work, when you work on something and you become better and better at it, and then sort of to see the magic of, you know, you're wrestling with, is this a bad song? Is this a good song? Is this a good, you know, is this a good chord? Is the arrangement off? Is the mix off? I mean, there's so many elements to a musical piece. And then it's just the creative process for anybody is pretty hard, right? So it's painful. So you go through this sort of birthing, I guess, of something, and then it makes its way through the system, through, you know, record label. Do they promote it? Do they promote it well? Where do they promote it? Are the radio stations going to pick it up or not? TV. Of course, this is before YouTube, right? So many things that are out of your hands, basically. And then, you know, like, to me, the magic was when they start selling the records, and then it hits TV, radio, you know, in the store, somebody buys the song and shares it with their friends, and then they share it with their friends. And it's this really bizarre moment when you go play a show somewhere in a city that you've never lived in, and these hundreds or thousands of people start singing the words you wrote, you know? And that's probably the biggest thing for me. It was the most amazing feeling to be able to have something here, and then it spreads and goes viral in a very mysterious way.
Yeah. So, you know, in the creative process, you know, does that affect how you pastor, as in, do you find that there's a lot of outlet for your creativity, and is it a similar, you know, process beginning in the mind, and you're kind of communicating, you know, thoughts that then become their own?
You know, when you're an artist, you're very, very aware that you're not entitled to people's attention, that they have to choose to come and spend their time listening to what you have to say. So I think it's similar in churches, that I'm very appreciative that there's, you know, a couple hundred people in the room or whatever, that chose to be there and chose to pay attention. And to me, that's a huge honor. So I take it pretty seriously. And the creative process is in that way similar, because, you know, you go, oh, how about this idea? You know, let's say, like, even this last week, I was in Colorado, and there's a couple of insights. One was that, you know, there's these avalanches, and you see the destruction, right? The avalanches happen in the winter when it's cold, but then we were here at the end of summer, and you see the path of the avalanche that is just brutal and massive, and goes for half a mile or a mile, jumps the highway and goes in the other direction. And it's just, and you can see trees being uprooted, and some of them, like, massive trees just bent to the ground, right? So you see the destruction, and then you look at the path of the avalanche, and you see the new life. You see the new trees, you see the flowers, you see this path of yellow, new life, right? So to me, it just struck me as something. So there's the spiritual parallels that God creates new life even in the path of destruction. So as somebody who speaks about God's love and power all the time, like you grab onto that and it just sort of simmers in your mind, and you know, and it's, oh, that's a good, that's really, it should be helpful. I should develop this idea. And you know, literally this morning, I wake up at 6 a.m. I was planning to sleep in, and I wake up at 6 a.m. because I just can't get those thoughts out of my mind. And I have these new ideas on how to make it more close to God's, to what God, how God works, and to communicate and inspire people. So I literally just gave up. Okay, I can't sleep now. 6 a.m. I'm writing these things down on my computer. The household is asleep. It's the same thing as an artist, right, who gets visited by a song or an idea or a melody or a chorus. Yeah. So it's very similar.
Very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're going to talk about culture. And just tell me, how many cultures kind of have you been a part of? How many cultures, you know, define you?
It is scary to think about, actually, because I grew up on three different this is my fourth continent. So I grew up in Europe, so Russia, Germany. In Latin America, I lived in Chile. In Africa, I lived in Mozambique. In America, I've lived all over the place. So this is my fourth continent. I learned four languages by age 9. So there's the sort of the linguistic, you know, ethnic cultural stuff. I am half Russian, half Chilean, so I learned Spanish and Russian in parallel. And then, you know, when we got to Africa, I was 7 years old, and they literally sent me to this African school, and you know, the language in Mozambique is Portuguese, so I learned Portuguese. And then literally a year after I was immersed in that, they sent me to an international school, actually, and where everything was in English, so I had to learn English. So I had to learn two languages in 2 years on top of the languages I already knew. So there's all these, you know, so linguistically, ethnically, there's all these influences. And then there's obviously the culture of East versus West, I think, that's very dramatically different, right? And probably the culture of being like a non-believer and not coming from a biblical, you know, background. My parents, you know, were atheists, you know, and so coming into the culture of where people are people of the book, sometimes for generations, it's pretty interesting. So there's quite a mix.
So I want to get, you know, into the cultures, but I'm curious, when it comes to, you know, growing up in an atheistic household, when for you did you say, you know, there is a God?
I think I was probably around, I was around 18 years old. I was going to college, and a friend of mine who was into Eastern philosophy and theosophy, actually, which was a thing. Apparently, it's making a comeback. I didn't know. Somebody told me the other day. But it's basically been comparative religion. That's what it is. And so this buddy of mine who was very close to me, he started telling me about these things, and I was like, you know, actually it does make sense. It's, you know, I started thinking, it's the core idea for me was, when you die, it just doesn't make any sense that that's it. You know, that was my core, I think, I don't know, my driver to explore, right? Because it just didn't make any sense to me that it was over. It just seemed so unnatural for some reason, right? So I got into Christianity way later. So I was into Eastern philosophy, New Age, for, you know, almost a decade. So since from 18 till when I was 26, when I became a Christian.
So could you pick three of those cultures and just tell me one thing from each that, you know, has helped you, you know, pastor better?
Yeah.
You know, something you've learned in each culture that has really helped you along.
That's a good question. All right. You know, I think, for example, in African culture, there's this very calm, serene view of suffering and pain. It's almost like there's a much there's much more acceptance that suffering is part of the human experience. And in America, I think the culture is to remove suffering of any kind or pain of any kind. And I think what we miss in American culture by doing so is that we stop having that perspective that, you know, part of following Jesus is to learn how to suffer well, because suffering, you won't remove it. It's irremovable in the fallen state that we're in the world. So I think being in the third world and seeing so much extreme poverty and acceptance of suffering in a much more graceful, organic way, that was a big thing that helped me. So that was good. I mean, there are certain things about culture that even like you, it helps me by knowing that what I don't believe, that I know that these things are bad, you know? So for example, in Eastern, when you go to Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church is basically this, DNA of it is basically that the church is everything and you are nothing. So that's a very distinct cultural imprint that actually influences every aspect of society, right? The church is everything, you are nothing. And therefore, the state is everything and you are nothing. And it actually affects economics, affects social dynamics and things like that. And I was an economics student. I got a master's in economics, so I sort of geek out on stuff like that. And it's fascinating how culture, you know, the Eastern culture in general is like that. The collective is way more important. The collective is here, the individual is here. And I think Russian culture is as well, sort of Eastern leaning, and it influences economics, people, church, all of it. And the way it helps me as a pastor is that I can recognize ultra-centralized groups become unhealthy when the individual is here, right? Mm-hmm. So it really helped me navigate church life, because there are church cultures that are like that, right? That the church is here, the leadership is here, and the individual is here. And I know just in my core, in my DNA, you know, like I have a sensitivity to that because of the cultures I was immersed in. And so when I pastor, my idea is that we need to elevate the individual and have a healthy balance between the collective and the individual, because that's the biblical view, I think. I think Jesus elevated both the us, the we, and the me, you know? But that's a big takeaway, and it influences, you know, the way I lead in a pretty significant way, you know?
Yeah. So from African, time in Africa, kind of an awareness of suffering from the time in Russia, kind of a sensitivity towards, you know, when the collective is getting too emphasized. What's a third takeaway from one of the cultures?
A third takeaway. Let's think. I think from maybe the culture of show business affected me, because it really helped me understand the power of viral, right? The power of an idea, a music, a movie, a cultural sort of thing, phenomenon, and how it spreads and how far it can go, right? If something it resonates with people, how it spreads beyond just the moment you communicate it, because it gets communicated over and over and over again to other people. And I believe that that's the power of the gospel originally. It was so irresistible, and it resonated when Jesus was speaking those words on the Sermon on the Mount. It was such a different, distinct view of life, you know, that people took it and it's, they told it to each other, right? And they spread the gospel. That's how the church spread organically. I think I feel I have that insight from show business because of that thing that I described earlier, right? You sit down and you write a song. I think it reflects something that other people are feeling, and it rings true, right? And it gets out there, and somehow in the very small steps became bigger and bigger steps, because it goes viral, right? So the viral, I think the viral quality of good communication that resonates with people is I really, really believe in that. And there's all kinds of nuances to it that I can go into, that I can geek out for probably an hour.
Well, I'm curious, like, you know, when you're viewing a movie or listening to, you know, music or something, and you know that the creators of it anticipated it going big and it just didn't.
Yeah.
You know, are there any times that you can call, you know, they were missing this, just obviously they were missing this component in making something successful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the thing is a creator of a film or a music or an art piece actually never fully knows if it's going to resonate or not. You have a best guess and sometimes he just doesn't. You know, so it's wonderful. But then at the same time there's an art to it and a science to it, right? So like one of my favorite things that I use all the time in communication, and you know, I own a company, we do a lot of marketing and business development. So we do a lot of communication stuff, right? We do websites, videos, all kinds of marketing stuff. And both in that and in preaching, the same sort of, I feel like they're the same natural laws of God that apply. And, you know, one of them that I use a lot as a construct is the hero's journey. And it's basically was developed by this guy, Joseph Campbell, who studied mythology and tales that people tell each other. And he basically can dissect any myth starting from, you know, from Greek mythology all the way to Steven Spielberg. Right? And they tend to have the same components, right? So I've studied that for a long time, and you know, as a storyteller, as a video director, and you know, as a writer, and I just love that because it's a tool where you can see, oh, look, if you tell the story this way, particularly, people will follow it better. And if you're trying to get an idea across, this is the better way to get the idea across.
Okay, culture. You talk a lot about third culture. What is third culture?
Oh, third culture is basically a term that was coined by someone, I think, in the 19th or 18th century. It was this lady. She's a British English lady, and she traveled to India with her husband and her kids. She was a journalist and I think a sociologist as well. And she discovered that her kids were from England, but they were not British, right? And they were not from India, but they were also sort of not Indian. They lived in India, but they were not fully Indian. So she coined that term being third culture, which means you sort of create the space that is in between, right? And third culture kids is sort of a term that spread, and you know, I was a third culture kid classically, right? So at my family dinner table in Mozambique, my dad would say something in Spanish. My mom would literally not even pause and answer him in Russian. He understands all of those languages. And then they would have a full-on conversation like that, no problem. And then my sister and I would either respond in one of those languages or use Portuguese, or if we didn't want my parents to understand what we're saying, we would use English because they didn't really speak English that well. So that's a third culture kid. And basically the cool aspect of that is that you learn how to navigate between worlds, right? And there's some downsides to that. You know, you're not very rooted. You know, you feel like you don't belong fully anywhere. You're an outsider. And there's some upsides to that, right? And the upsides is that you have this ability to understand the core of the people you want to connect with and align with them, right? And you really sincerely want to get to know these outsiders for you and be an insider for an outsider, you know? So there's this it's a quality, right, that you have when you're living between worlds all the time. And sort of the reason I talk about it is because I feel like a lot of the same characteristics can be applied to the early Christian faith, right? They were outsiders, they were the minority, No one knew who they were. They were not mainstream. They were not institutionalized yet. And both Jesus and the apostles had sort of some of the same characteristics of a third culture kid, of a third culture in general, is that they would just cross over. They would step beyond where other people of the same culture sort of stayed and stuck together. They would go beyond that. So that's why Jesus was accused of being a drunkard and a glutton and hanging out with prostitutes and the tax collectors. And he just wanted to be with them because these are the people that needed him the most. And it's the same, and he was accused by the establishment that was an ungodly way to be. And I think that's exactly how we should be, right? And Paul famously, he was a third culture kid, actually. Well, Jesus was the cosmic third culture kid, right? Because he was the Son of God who was incarnated and became part of us, right? He would be hungry and thirsty and needs sleep and can feel pain. So he's the ultimate third culture kid, right? The uber third culture kid. But then the Apostle Paul, if you see about his biography, it's very interesting that he was a very traditional Jewish guy who learned at the feet of Gamaliel in Jerusalem, but he lived actually, and I think he was born in Tarsus. And Tarsus is not a very Jewish city, it's a very Greek city. So that's why he was the only one of the sort of the Jewish apostles who mentioned sports, for example, as an analogy for spiritual things. Why? Well, he was exposed to Greek culture. Like, the Jews didn't talk about sports. They didn't have games or Olympic games and nothing like that, right? They probably had something, but it wasn't a mainstream thing for Jews to talk about sports as an analogy. That's why Jesus didn't, right? He talked about farming to connect to people. And Paul talks about sports. He speaks like a Greek philosopher. He can quote Greek poets from memory. So he was a third culture kid because he knew the Pharisaic, very strict way. He knew his Bible, he knew the culture, and yet he also knew Greek culture, and that made him incredibly effective as an apostle. And he was qualified in ways that Peter wasn't qualified. So you need Peter for one thing, one kind of work in the early church, and you need Paul for another kind of work in the early church. And Paul was the one who was the third culture apostle, basically. And Peter wasn't.
And so you're kind of inviting people to see themselves as third culture. And what if someone is just very confident and comfortable in their own culture, you know, the dominant culture. What's the danger of not being third culture?
Well, I think the danger of not being third culture is when this fresh faith that was given to us by the apostles that we read in the Bible that were so inspired by the early church and the apostles and Jesus and the early Christians and how they lived and loved and how they generously proclaimed the gospel all over the place, all over the Roman Empire. If that slowly becomes, it's more about us than about them outside, it shifts the tone of how we operate as Christians. And from that grows institutionalized Christianity, and religiosity in general is rooted in that shift from being third culture and being about the hero being the person who needs it the most, from the hero being us. This is how we do things. This is how we are. Everybody in my circles, in my town, in my culture behaves like this. Therefore, you should behave like this. And you can make it look very compassionate, but it's not in its core.
What's a kind of repentance that you feel like, we could be experiencing now proactively and that would help the church to, get back into its core mission and not just trying to kind of maintain our cultural clout?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's sort of what that was the question that we were asking when we started the community. We started about 6 years ago here in Austin, Texas. We, you know, Deb and I, my wife and I, moved from Los Angeles, and we were a part of a church, really good, really amazing group of people who we love deeply, and yet sort of it was more of a mega church type feel. And we felt that there was something there, even though the people individually were amazing people, and we've learned so much from them and served them, and they served us. But something in the dynamic of the group was not conducive, I guess, right, to rediscovering the treasure and in keeping it about the treasure, right? So when we planted Tribe, we sort of planted it on purpose to be very, like, that was the idea. It's like, how do we get it? Like, we love this thing. We love the gospel. We love the Bible. We love this life that we have. How do we maintain that even for ourselves so that we're sane, you know, as leaders, that it doesn't become weird and doesn't become about a hierarchy of some sort, that it stays profoundly love-filled and service-filled and connection-filled. And so in some way, it's sort of a selfish way. How do we create a community? And are there other people that are feeling like we're feeling? You know, that was probably a big question. You know, it was like, are we really weird or what? You know, and so we basically started putting it out there and going, you know, maybe we are weird, but this is what we're feeling. You know, we really want something, an environment where people know each other, love each other, do life with each other, know everything about each other, pray for each other. And we want an environment where that would be the norm, that would be the baseline, not an aspiration, but a baseline. So how do we create environments and small groups and church in general that supports that as you know, what do we preach about, what we emphasize, you know? So that was the sort of the whole birth of Tribe was around how do we make the treasure and try to avoid making other things the treasure, you know? So, and I think we landed on just, for example, one of the things we landed on is that we're a network and not a hierarchy. We are leadership. Even my sort of thing is, you know, as the guy who planted it, it's not a rank, but it's just a role, and roles change over time. There's a lot of little components that we've introduced in our life, all of them based on some scriptural insights that we've had. I mean, one of them is we don't want to make a church because it's very hard to make the treasure in a crowd. You get lost very quickly. You can be extremely talented and maybe there are people out there who can make it that work in a large group. I'm not that person. So like maybe it's just my limitations, right? So, but in our case, we just said, look, we're going to keep it a certain size, and we're sending out a new group to plant another church in a few months. And that's, we want to multiply rather than add, you know, add more people, we want to multiply churches. So that's another component. There's just so many things. We actually developed a PowerPoint deck that explains these cultural DNA, and it's actually called the Tribe Ethos, right? Which is another word for culture.
Very cool. Well, Chris, you're going to be at the Renew Gathering in Franklin, Tennessee on November 6th, and you're going to be doing a workshop there. Kind of tell us what you're going to be talking about.
Well, I'm going to be talking about two things that are related. One is this startup mentality, right? And why it's a hard thing to do, but it's an incredible advantage to rediscover that in yourself as a church leader, right? But then connected to that, what I'm going to be talking about is very specific practical things about how, because of that mentality, the early church took advantage of an information revolution that was going on in the Roman Empire at the time, because, you know, beyond the fact that the power of God started the church and the faith of the disciples spread the church, there was also God's providence of when this was all happening in history. And I believe it was God's providence that the church started in the Roman Empire, because there was this massive territory that was connected through safe travel, through really good roads, through language connections, through cultural connections. And so it was an information revolution at the time. So the church took advantage of that fully. And that was, it's really important to remember that that was a very key thing. We wouldn't be here if they hadn't taken advantage of it. Now, in the modern, in the 21st century, I think because we're, you know, the church is more institutionalized, we're not taking advantage of the information revolution, of the biggest informational revolution we've seen in the history of humanity. We can impact millions instantly in all kinds of ways, right? And the church is, you know, I think we just don't have that mentality of let's just do anything we can to reach as many as possible. And because of that, I think we're missing the train. So I'm going to be talking about why that is and how that can be changed.
Very cool. Hey, one more question. In keeping with our theme of three, what are maybe three ways that churches can, you know, very practically get their message out and kind of rise above the noise, so that they're heard and so that the message can really get out there?
Well, I think one is start treating, one is being third culture. Like that's really at the core, is understanding, exploring what that is, even being able to question, where are we centric, so that we can shift it to them centric, right? So it's a core shift in the mentality of a church group that usually starts with the leadership, or maybe starts from the fringes, from a group that has some sort of revival and like they've rediscovered the treasure and they start just living a certain way and then it sort of spreads, right? So that's one. The other one is fully exploring and humbly learning about the information revolution, right? Is what is it exactly? You know, we all know, I mean, we all are connected. We know what the internet is. I get that. But it's, what is the cost of opportunity? You know, in business it's called cost of opportunity. What are the things, how much is it costing us that we're not embracing it fully, impact-wise? And just having that very honest conversation that to see that gap is a really huge thing because it motivates people to go, oh, I think we need to change, right? It's repentance. And then the third thing is in the words of Paul, using all means possible to win as many as possible. So once you've realized there's a gap, go into that gap, right? Invest resources and expertise and people into using the information revolution to the fullest extent possible so that we can win as many as possible, because that was the heart of the apostles. That was the heart of Jesus. And technology is just a means to that. But if we don't use that technology, it almost means, well, I don't think we're using everything we can to reach as many as possible. And we can be honest about that. And it's a humbling thing to think and say, because it triggers us sort of this need for us to repent. So those would be the three things, I think.
Please keep coming back to renew.org to find more audio posts like this one. And while you're there, click to find more info about our upcoming Renew gathering on November 6th in the Nashville area. We would absolutely love to see you come out to that this year. This is Dave Stovall signing out. Thanks so much for listening.